Coming up on Fronteras, the technology industry in Mexico is on the rise thanks in part to small startups taking a chance in a highly competitive field.
Our first office was a table in an apartment of a friend.
The Fronteras desk travels to Monterrey to meet the geeks of Mexico. Wisconsin dairy farmer John Rosno hires workers from Mexico.
I've been called slave trader. I've been called somebody that runs an underground railroad and probably a whole lot of worse things behind my back. What I basically am is I'm a dairy farmer, trying to make a living in a difficult industry.
How one dairy farmer sees his workers as his assets. But first, the news. Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among 7 public radio stations and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. Immigration reform takes a step forward. A key Senate panel this week approved an immigration bill that would provide a pathway to citizenship for the at least 11 million unauthorized immigrants here. The legislation would impact people John Rosno hires. He's a fifth-generation dairy farmer. Times have changed since his Norwegian ancestors began farming in Cochrane, Wisconsin. And Rosno has changed with the times. Much of his workforce is now from Mexico. And Rosno travels regularly to their village in southern Mexico to meet their families. The Fronteras desk sent reporter Laurel Morales to Rosno's farm to check out this new binational dairy industry.
John Rosno wakes up every morning at 3:30. He used to work almost 100 hours a week, but he says he's slowing down. Now he works closer to 80 hours, and it's not easy work.
I considered quitting, and then I thought of what I did during the day, because I really wasn't making any money. Did I like what I did? And I really loved what I did.
Rosno's business has grown. He and his workers now milk 550 cows 3 times a day. 8 out of 20 hired laborers are from Mexico. Family and neighbors make up the rest.
I've been called slave trader. I've been called somebody that runs an underground railroad and probably a whole lot of worse things behind my back. What I basically am is I'm a dairy farmer, trying to make a living in a difficult industry.
Rosno actually pays fairly well, $27,000 to $40,000 a year. He also pays for health care and housing for all of his workers. We know from surveys, not all farmers treat their employees this well.
Hey, we got something for you to eat out here, huh?
The tall but gentle farmer tries to sweet-talk a new calf out of her hut. Rosno guides me around the mud puddles to a semi-truck that he fills up with milk each day and sells to the cheese creamery across the street. In addition to dairy farming, he also has a profitable composting business. Rosno scoops up a handful of what looks like rich black dirt.
We sell that to gardeners and landscapers. Because of the rain, it's sopping wet right now.
When he started hiring workers from Mexico, Rosno decided to learn Spanish. His interpreter, Sean Duvall, suggested an immersion program in Mexico.
We had a meeting because we had the trip all arranged, and I said, is there anything else you'd like to do? And John said, well, I'd like to go see where my employees are from. And I'm like, duh!
Since Rosno has gone down, 150 other Wisconsin dairy farmers have followed.
The employers realize that they owe these guys a lot more than just a paycheck. And so they become interested in their welfare and in their family's welfare. And they are extremely marginalized in these communities. They're some of the poorest places in all of Mexico.
It was quite a powerful experience to visit those people that are back there getting checks from their husband, usually working up here.
Without papers, most of these workers don't risk a visit home, so they often do not see their families for years.
Erasmo?
Sí.
Soy Laurel.
Erasmo has slept in after a late milking shift on Rosno's farm. He sits back in a recliner while others who share the kitchen come in and out while we talk. Erasmo points to a picture of his boss with his family in Veracruz. He didn't want us to use his last name.
Buena persona el patrón y bueno, pues yo lo respeto y él pues.
He says Rosno is a good person. I respect him. Each time Rosno goes back, he sees where the paychecks go. He has seen the standard of living in this village change. They go from dirt floors to concrete, from cooking over a fire to a gas stove. To push this process even further, he's given business classes to some of his workers who wish to use their paycheck to start a restaurant, bakery, or other business back in Mexico someday. Everybody on Rosno's farm comes from the same village. These days, when someone leaves, they send back a neighbor or cousin to take their place. Rosno's optimistic the latest proposals for immigration reform will pass, eventually allowing his workers to visit their families whenever they want or bring them safely to Wisconsin to be with them. I'm Laurel Morales, reporting in Wisconsin.
Let's call it the snowbird provision. Buried in more than 800 pages of the immigration reform legislation headed for more debate is a proposal that would allow Canadians to visit second homes in the U.S. for up to 8 months a year. It's one of two proposals in the bill aimed at boosting foreign retirements here. From the Fronteras desk in Phoenix, Jude Jaffe Block reports.
Well, that's quite new. That's new.
Yeah, it's brand new.
French-Canadian couple Cecile Bastin and Sylvain Côté are touring a vacant townhouse in central Phoenix with their realtor. Canadians flocked to the Phoenix area in recent years when home prices plummeted and there was a glut of homes on the market. Canadians lead the pack of foreign buyers here by far. They bought 15,000 homes in the past 4 years here, according to the Information Market, a firm that analyzes real estate data.
There's a lot of shaggy carpets around here.
Bastin and Côté are looking for a winter vacation home.
Or someplace where we can easily access and we can just put our feet up, enjoy the weather, eat outside, and say, oh, they're under 10 feet of snow up there in Canada.
Tucked into the Senate immigration bill are two provisions to give couples like Bastin and Côté even more flexibility for spending time in the U.S. when they hit the age of 55. One allows Canadians who own or rent property here to visit for 8 months, up from the current six-month maximum. Another grants foreigners from any country three-year renewable visas if they invest $500,000 in cash in real estate and come with their own health insurance.
It will allow me to enjoy the property in the U.S. much more than I currently do.
John Ryan is Canadian and a part-time Arizonan.
Well, currently I have five properties in Phoenix, one a personal property and four investment rental properties.
We reached Ryan by phone at his primary residence in British Columbia. He's just a couple years shy of the 55-year-old age requirement. He likes the idea of a retirement visa for property owners like him.
And certainly will be a boon to the local economy because the Canadians will be down purchasing retirement homes and everything that goes along with that, furniture, food, meals, restaurants, entertainment.
New York Senator Chuck Schumer first introduced something similar to this idea in 2011 at a time when the housing market was overrun with vacant homes. Here he is promoting it back then on CNBC.
There are loads of people who would like to live here. Loads of people who would like to live here. This is a way of letting them live here and helping solve our housing crisis.
Schumer is now a member of the Gang of Eight senators that drafted the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill. He also backs giving Canadian snowbirds extended visits. The Canadian Snowbird Association, which has registered lobbyists in D.C., says they worked closely with Schumer's office to get the provision included in the bill. They aren't the only foreign group singled out for special privileges either. The massive legislation has deals for Irish and South Korean workers.
In terms of the political and policy discussion, many of these things are flying under the radar.
Ron Hira is a public policy professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology.
It's almost like stealth immigration policy where you've got these smaller bits, or what seem to be smaller bits, and individually they seem maybe not to have a major impact. But collectively, they would have a significant impact.
Both retiree provisions were probably included in the legislation because they promise potential economic benefits. But Michael Orr of Arizona State University's W.P. Carey School of Business says encouraging foreign real estate sales may not be needed in places like Phoenix at the moment.
The Canadians did a great job buying lots of homes just when nobody else was very interested. And we're very grateful to them for that. But now everybody's active in the market.
So much so, it's getting tough for locals to buy homes in Phoenix.
And there just aren't enough homes to go around.
Creating immigration incentives for foreign buyers could make the housing market even more competitive. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Jaffe Block.
There's still more fronteras coming up. The technology industry in Mexico is on the rise thanks in part to small startups taking chances.
Our first office was a table in an apartment of a friend.
We travel to Monterrey to take a look at Mexico's tech industry. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. In the last decade, Mexico's tech industry has flourished, growing three times faster than the global average. Most of that growth is fueled by demand from the United States. But as Mónica Ortiz Uribe reports, without certain reforms, Mexico's progress will only go so far.
The star of a video featured on Mexico's Forbes magazine website is this woman.
Por supuesto que existe Blanca Treviño, existe una Blanca Treviño.
Blanca Treviño is the CEO of Softec, Mexico's biggest technology service company. Softec spans four continents, providing software support to clients that include Fortune 500 companies. It's a business sector that's growing rapidly in Mexico, thanks in large part to its proximity to the United States.
I think it's safe to say that without the U.S., the Mexico market would not be doing very well.
Morgan Yates is an analyst with the IT consulting firm Gartner. He says 75% of tech outsourcing in Mexico is consumed by the U.S. market. That is, large global companies like Walmart or Coca-Cola that need help managing massive computer databases. For years, India and China have been the main providers of these services, but that's changing.
More and more partnerships are happening between the U.S. and Mexico.
U.S. companies tend to mesh better with Mexican providers. Time zones are more compatible, and Mexico is better able to serve a growing Hispanic market within the U.S. But it's not all about IT support and services. This song was embedded into an online music review by an alternative Vermont newspaper called 7 Days. The newspaper used a software program developed by a Mexican startup called Publish 88. The startup is one of many popping up across Mexico trying to develop original software they can copyright. Enrique Lima is the co-founder of Publish 88.
Our first office was a table in an apartment of a friend.
Today, their office is practically incognito within a quiet residential neighborhood in Monterrey, Mexico's northern industrial hub. Publish 88 licenses software to print publishers that want a multimedia presence. Just a year in, Publish 88 has clients like National Geographic magazine in Mexico. Emilio Arriaga is the chief financial officer.
Publish 88 is an incredible example of what you can do if you set yourself to your goals and you plan and you work hard.
But while big companies like Softec are doing business with other big companies worldwide, it's a lot tougher for smaller Mexican companies like Publish 88 to score foreign clients. Mexico's tech savvy is not widely known. There is no Silicon Valley of Mexico, not yet. The country still thirsts for innovation. No one knows that better than Guillermo Safa, a 40-year veteran of the industry here.
Estamos caminando con el freno de mano puesto.
We are driving with our handbrake on, he says. Safa directs an IT business alliance in Monterrey. He says Mexico has important challenges to overcome.
Capital humano.
Human capital is one, Safa says. Most engineering graduates in Mexico end up in the manufacturing sector. The other challenge is financing. Mexico's conservative banking institutions are not small business friendly. That said, a bill meant to reform the banking system is currently making its way through the Mexican Congress. Meanwhile, Mexican universities like the Tec de Monterrey are nurturing the country's future entrepreneurs. At this interactive study center, you'll find bright colors, foosball tables, and trampolines, all meant to stimulate ideas. It works for freshman Rodrigo Medina.
Well, I'm working on an app that helps you to find objects that you don't remember where you left them.
So. Like your car keys.
Exactly, car keys, the wallet, the cell phone.
Medina hopes to start his own business when he graduates. His success will be determined in part by how much support he gets back from his own country. Reporting from Monterrey, Mexico, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
San Diego will soon have a youth orchestra linking musicians from both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. But heightened border security and concerns about violence in Mexico can complicate such initiatives. As Jill Replegal from our Fronteras desk reports, organizers say it's worth the effort.
Select musicians from this orchestra, from the Centro de Artes Musicales in Tijuana, and this one, the San Diego Young Artists Symphony, will play together next season in the first ever Youth Orchestra of the Californias. San Diego's mainly Mozart Festival is behind the initiative. The music directors of the Tijuana and San Diego Youth Orchestras will begin meeting next month to map out their vision for the project. Rehearsals and performances will be held in San Diego during the first year. That means Mexican musicians will face long waits to cross the border. Nancy Laterno-Boyanich is founding executive director of Mainly Mozart. The organization has been holding performances south of the border for 22 years.
You have to be in it for the long run, or it can just be too complicated.
She says she hopes the binational orchestra will help educate people in the U.S. and in Mexico about the cultural richness that exists on both sides of the fence. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replegal.
Crawford High School in San Diego's City Heights neighborhood is one of the most diverse schools in the nation. Students' families hail from Vietnam, Cambodia, Mexico, and Somalia, among others. Just imagine how delicious a school-wide potluck might be. Well, one university professor dreamed up a way to share some of that culinary richness while capitalizing on America's obsession with cooking shows. From our Fronteras desk, Jill Replegal reports.
So directors, in order to get something going, you say, quiet on the set.
Mics and cameras are in place, mixing bowls and perfectly measured ingredients neatly laid out. This group is ready to film a high school cooking show.
Sweet potato pie, scene 6, take 1.
Today we're making a sweet potato and apple pie, which is our version of a traditional soul food dessert. So, Dominique, can you tell us what soul food is?
Soul food is a type of comfort food.
The show's called Cooking It Up. It lives as a series of webisodes, along with recipes and personal stories behind those recipes.
So Nathan's on sound. Jesse's doing the clapboard.
Christine Diekman directs the program. She teaches video and new media at Cal State San Marcos. Her college students serve as mentors and tech support on the show. For the Crawford High School students, it's an internship where they learn video production, graphic design, nutrition, and...
A lot of them just wanted to learn how to cook. So many of them come from families, very busy families, and they are responsible for cooking nutritious foods within their homes.
So they wanted to learn cooking basics, how to chop an onion, how to handle and store food safely, how to make it good for you. Crystal Gillespie is an 11th grader at Crawford High. She co-directed the sweet potato pie episode.
I cook a lot at home, and, you know, my grandmother runs a daycare, so the idea of finding healthy ways to make snacks was really great, because then that's something else I can do for the kids that's interesting.
The students take turns working in different roles in show production, directing, manning the cameras and microphones, and for the brave ones, trying out their best Iron Chef in front of the camera.
Bam! Chopsticks!
This is an episode where they make green papaya salad from South Asia. Some of the students are from families who've recently arrived as immigrants and refugees. They bring traditional recipes and cooking smarts to the show. And something else, a deep connection to food through family hardships and joys. One of the students, Nathan Yao, got the papaya salad recipe from his grandparents, who lived in Cambodia during the bloody rule of the Khmer Rouge. Nathan tells their story on the Cooking It Up website.
Their long, long friend, he became a monk because his parents were killed during that regime. So then, and he really liked papaya salad, so then they decided to start bringing papaya salad always to him because he didn't really have nobody except for us.
And another thing students from immigrant families bring, generally, good eating habits.
Researchers have found that immigrants tend to be in better shape when they arrive in the U.S. than Americans. It's known as the healthy immigrant effect. Here's Professor Diekman.
Healthy eating practices are still alive here. But as the youth become more and more acculturated, and I can see it with this group of youth, they're starting to eat more junk food.
Diekman says this is the time to get them, to encourage them to carry on their kitchen traditions and learn from each other.
So now we're going to be adding half a cucumber.
In this episode, ninth grader Jesse Aviles shows his classmates how to make and eat ceviche, hardly a standard American teenage meal.
And the last thing you need are some tostadas.
So what you want to do is get a big piece and a small piece. And you're going to use a small piece to scoop up some ceviche onto the tostada.
Thanks, Jesse. This is great, you guys. You want to try some?
Yeah!
The skills these high schoolers are learning, like motion graphics and video editing, could lead to jobs in the digital world. Or take Aviles, the ceviche master. He actually thinks he might want to become a chef, so he appreciates the kitchen skills he's picked up.
Like, you know, the putting your fingers back so you won't chop off your finger and, you know, accidentally miss a finger for probably forever.
In this fast food world, just getting young people interested in cooking seems like a small victory. In any case, it's probably better than sitting in the classroom.
Because you get to cook, and then you get to eat what you cook. I mean, who doesn't love that?
In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. We're online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook, and we invite you to join the conversations there and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is fronterasdesk. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.